Right. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Tech Days, to the pre-conference. Thank you all for coming in a day early for hopefully what becomes a full day of content for you. My name is Matt Milner. I'm an instructor with Pluralsight, and I'm going to be here all day trying to cover as much as I can about what's new in .NET 4. That's a pretty big task. I think we'll get to quite a bit of things, but we won't probably cover everything. So I apologize if your favorite new feature isn't covered or we don't go in depth, but hopefully we'll give you a good sense of all the new things that are coming in .NET 4 with a release coming up in just a couple weeks, give you an idea about the frameworks, new tools, updates to some of your existing tools that you've been using. As I mentioned, I'm an instructor with Pluralsight, so we do instructor-led training and online training as well. We can go in and watch the videos, so we've got classes on a lot of this stuff we'll be talking about today. This morning, we're going to start with kind of a broad look at the framework itself, so the languages, the base class libraries, some of the core improvements to things like Windows Presentation Foundation. We're going to look at a couple of key components that are new, like the Managed Extensibility Framework, the Parallel Extensions, and the Dynamic Language Runtime. Just try and give you a sense of what those are and how you might be able to use them in your applications. Throughout the day, we're going to go over a lot of other technologies, Windows Communication Foundation, Windows Workflow. We've got a session on the Entity Framework and WCF Data Services, and we've got a session dedicated to what's new in ASP.NET and MVC in that space. Hopefully, you'll ask questions. It's a big room. I've got lights in my face, so I can't see everybody. So you may be raising your hand, and I can't see. Please feel free to just holler out and let me know you have a question. And with that, we'll go ahead and get started. Now, I have to apologize. How many of you have children? Okay. So I love my children. I have two boys. But here's the thing about kids. They bring stuff home. And lots of times it's cute things like drawings they've done or their homework. But a lot of times my kids bring home other things that aren't so cute, like colds, stomach flus, things like that. So I apologize. I don't have any jet lag, but I did get ill, which I'm sure is for my littlest son, after I got here. So I will. I hopefully am back and recovered, but I apologize if my energy level drops throughout the day. All right. So to start with the .NET framework, one of the key things to understand is that we've moved now to .NET Framework 4. An interesting thing about the .NET frameworks is we really haven't had a new CLR, a new runtime, since .NET Framework 2. .NET Framework 3 and .NET Framework 3.5 were really just additions to the compilers and to the base class library. So the core runtime, even when you're using .NET 3.5 features, was always the 2.0 runtime. If you've done web development and you go into IIS and try and pick your target runtime, you'll know that 3.0 and 3.5 never show up there. And so this brings some significant opportunities, and one of the things they did is they've refactored and they've made some changes where you can now target not only .NET 2 or 3 or 3.5, you can also target different profiles. So if I'm writing an application and the goal is that this is a desktop application, you probably don't need to have ASP.NET and all the server-side assemblies on your desktop to run my application. So we have a new client profile that means you can download a smaller version of the .NET Framework 4, a subset that's geared towards the client profile of the desktop. So you don't get all the server-side things that you don't care about and are just going to sit there unused. Now, it's important to understand that because a lot of the new project types in Visual Studio 2010, as you go in and create them, will default to that client profile. And that means that as you try and add assembly references or go out and use certain features, you may not be able to find them, or they may be filtered out of your lists when you go to add references. So on your project properties, you can always change that target profile, but you need to be aware that that's there. The other thing they've enabled now with .NET 4 is the ability to run multiple versions of the CLR in a host application. This wasn't possible with the previous versions. And where this really opens up is for things like add-in development. If you write a managed add-in for Outlook or another Office application, now Office will be able to host both .NET 2 add-ins as well as .NET 4 add-ins. So we have this ability to run these now in the same process, which opens up a lot of backwards compatibility and migration scenarios. So there's just a couple of the key things in the framework itself. In terms of the base class library updates, there are probably hundreds of little small ones. Again, this is one of those places where I picked a few things that I noticed that seemed interesting. There's some new collection classes like the sorted set, which allows you, as you add things into the set, they automatically get sorted. We've got a new class called Lazy of T. Now, this provides a generic wrapper around lazy instantiation of objects. And this ends up getting used by some of the frameworks we'll talk about today, like the Managed Extensibility Framework. So you have the ability to create this lazy of T, and you provide it with not only the type you want to create, but a function that instructs it, you know, that it can call when you want to create that. So only when you go to access the value of this does it actually instantiate the object. This could be really useful for things like connections to resources, database connections or other system connections, those sorts of things, where if the user doesn't actually go down your code path to use that value, you don't want to instantiate it. You don't want to create that object if it's not going to be used. There's a new pattern for observation. So we have these very simple interfaces of iObservable and iObserver, where I can use the iObservable, which just has a subscribe method. You subscribe to me, tell me what you want to watch or observe, and then you have a callback interface that I can use to call you back and let you know or notify you when those things have changed. And there's other things like the tuple class that that makes it easier to manage sets of data. Now, there's a bunch of little things that you'll find in the framework, and I've just called out a few here, but kind of the little, for some, the little gems where you see this and you just think, oh, finally, they got around to putting that in there so I don't have to write that over and over again. Right, like stream.copyTo. How many times have you written a function to copy from one stream to another? Right, I've probably written that 100 times. It's always the same code, and I've always wondered why it wasn't just in the framework, and now it is. Right. We have some additions to the string class, which we use all over the place. Things like the string.join, where now I have a join of T, I can pass in a set of objects, and it will essentially call toString on them, and I can join on all those things. So I don't have to have just a collection of strings. For example, I might have a whole collection of integers, and I want to concatenate those together or join them together. So I can use that join and pass in that IEnumerable of integers, and it will call toString on them and use whatever information I provide for the separator. All right. So there are some other things in there, like the GUID class. You can now parse things. There are additions to the mail libraries to support SSL. Right, there's a variety of kind of little changes like that in the framework that you'll find. In the languages, there's really not a huge amount of change in both Visual Basic and C Sharp. There's a few core features that were added to the languages, but we haven't seen a lot here. And some of that comes from the fact that in .NET 3.5 we had Link, and we've had all these other language enhancements over the past few versions. So in C Sharp, the big one is support for this notion of dynamic objects. And this is really part of the goal for two areas. One is working with things like COM interop, office programmability, where people are working with these libraries. If you've ever worked with Office, they have these function calls that have probably 15 parameters. Well, when you're doing VB or you're doing Visual Basic for Applications, a lot of those things are optional, and so you can just leave them out. Or you can supply these different, you can do named values. Those things are now supported in C Sharp, along with this notion of the dynamic object, which is essentially an object that's method calls get dispatched and resolved at runtime. So we'll take a look at the dynamic just briefly, and then later in the session when we talk about the dynamic language runtime and working with things like Python and IronRuby, we'll see how that can be used as well. And then we also have this notion of contravariance and covariance. I don't know about you, but I can never keep these straight in my head. Essentially, when we're using types and we're doing derivation, right? You make a method call or you have a particular property and you want to set a value, it's the ability to use a more derived type or a less derived type. Right? So I have a property of type person. I want to set it with an employee object. Employee derives from person. What they've added is support for generics now, so that if I have an IEnumerable of person, I can pass in an IEnumerable of that employee. This is something that, you know, again, you may have run into. You'd know if it was a problem for you if you run into it. If not, you may just have thought, hey, why doesn't that just work? I would have assumed that just worked. All right. For Visual Basic, we're playing a little bit of catch-up here with C#, but we have now auto-implemented properties. So my get and set logic is automatically generated by the compiler with an auto-generated backing field. I don't have to write that. We have collection initializers, and then implicit line continuation. So VB, you've always had to have that little line continuation marker to tell the compiler, hey, I'm going to break here and go down to the next line to write some more code, and kind of instruct it to follow you down to that next line. That now, as long as you, as long as you're on the next line, and you're not missing a line, that marker now is no longer necessary. And then finally, with the lambda expressions, you now can do multi-line lambda expressions. So those two kind of go together now that the compiler can understand those multi-line statements. So let's just go out here and take a look at some of these. So how many people are Visual Basic developers here? Only a handful. Okay. A little surprising, but good, because this is about the only Visual Basic I'm going to write today. And when you see me write Visual Basic, you'll know why. So I'm going to write a class here just quick to show you some of this. So I've got a library out here with a person class. Right, very basic, has a name, an age, and a date of birth. Just so I've got a couple different data types, and I've got a toString on there. And I've imported that over here, and I'm just going to create my employee class over here. Oops. So we'll put that in there. So we've got an employee that inherits person. So now normally if you use the snippets, right, you're going to get a full-blown property here with the backing field, the getter, the setter that implements that. What you can do now, if you want to simply do one of these auto-implemented properties, is just put in public property, put the name, and give it the type. So if we build that up, that works. And so behind the scenes, this is all just kind of syntactic sugar, right? This is just nice stuff that the compiler does for us. Behind the scenes, it's going to create a backing field. It's going to generate a get and set method for us and use that backing field. If you look at the intermediate language for this, you're going to see those particular values that the compiler created. The benefit is that as you move forward, if you decide that you do need some logic in the get or the set, you can come back and add the get and set, put that logic in. It doesn't change your interface. Right? It's still a property as opposed to a field that allows you to come back later and add in that logic if you need to. All right. So we'll just quick look at the initializers then, since we don't have too many folks here. So I'm going to do a IEnumerable of person. You can see my skills with the keyboard in VB are not quite the same. So I'm going to dim this as an iron numerable of person. So I want to create a I want to create my collection here. All right, let me get this out of the way. So we've got our creating this as an iNumerable equal new. I need to learn how to type. IEnumerable from, and then we get into creating this, the actual entity. So use the from keyword here to go out and initialize the collection. Then I can do a new person with age equals 38. And name, yes. Ah, thank you, Josh. I'm too quick with the return. There we go. So new person with, and then we can add in some additional ones. Right. There we go. So now we've got our collection of people, right? So pretty basic, gives us the same kind of things we've done with Visual Basic and C Sharp now. So with the contravariance and the covariance, so if I do a function, something like find oldest, and we'll take our people as IEnumerable person and give back a person. So what that means is now I can pass in either my collection of people here, or I can pass in a collection of employees. All right, so I could simply take this. And add in do something like that. We'll make it an integer. Add in the employees. Oops. See, I've got that semicolon going. There we go. Right. So this allows me to call those functions. I can use this not only for function calls, but if I've got properties or I've got delegates now, like if I have an action of T or a func of T, I've got the ability to set that with derived types as well. So we could come down here and do a little link. We could say we've got a return people do the max, and so we'll have to pass in our function. So we can go in, return that person back out. We can use that that piece in there. So let me set that as the startup. Oh, I got too many results. P.h equals. All right, this is where my crowd IntelliSense comes in. Passed in my employees, age of 38, or age equals people.max. Ah. This is the same problem I had, so I have to actually write something out, don't I? Can you tell I do C sharp? There we go. I told you wouldn't want to watch me write VB for very long. So I had the same problem with the ASP.NET demos. I'd put all the data controls and everything on, and then I'd wonder, why isn't anything showing up on the page? I don't have a list view or a grid view. So that's just a quick introduction to the VB stuff. In C sharp, we'll just look real quickly here. I just want to call out, how many of you are familiar with the var keyword in C sharp? You're familiar with that from the previous versions? Var essentially is, look, I'm kind of lazy and I don't want to declare what type he's going to be, but I still want the compiler to figure it out at runtime. Or rather at compile time, I want it to figure out what that type is. So if I do p dot, I get all the properties and methods. It knows that that's a person, right? Because it can reflect back and see that I instantiated it as a person object. The new keyword in C sharp is dynamic. And here, if I do d dot, I get nothing. Right? This isn't going to figure out at compile time what that type is, nor what methods it has, what properties it has, and what it can do. Instead, it's going to wait till runtime, and at that point, it'll do all the method dispatching and figure that out. So this is really useful when I start working with things like that com interop to VB, or when we start talking about dynamic languages like Python and Ruby, that's how they work. They have these objects, and the dispatching happens at runtime. Right, so I can still use this. I could still come in. And I can do d dot first name, d dot age. And at runtime, it's going to figure out that object, and I can do a console write line. It's going to figure out at runtime that whatever entity that is, it's going to try and call those methods, or in this case for the properties, it's going to try and access those. So I can use that dynamic object. It doesn't give me IntelliSense, but I can put any method call, any property call that I want on it. And as long as the object has that method or that property at runtime, everything's great. So this comes down to your preference for, you know, statically typed languages versus dynamic languages. It's very useful, especially as you're working with those dynamic languages, but you aren't going to see your errors or your problems at compile time. You're only going to find those when you get to runtime. All right, so let's move on to some of the other features in the framework past the language stuff. So Windows Presentation Foundation has gotten some new improvements, some things that people really wished were there in the first one. We have some new controls Finally, we have a built-in data grid. We've got a calendar and a date picker. A lot of people, you know, really thought these should have been in the first one. They're pretty core controls that people use every day. And so they finally got those into the framework now with 4.0. And then there's some behind-the-scenes things like the text rendering is much improved. And a lot of these things were driven from the Visual Studio team. You know, they were using WPF to build out a lot of the core features in Visual Studio 2010. And so they were finding, you know, performance enhancements, and they were finding text rendering enhancements that could be made. And a lot of that got pushed back into the framework so that the rest of us would benefit from it as well. There's some enhancements to the designer as well. You know, a lot of times people have been doing WPF and they've been spending a lot of time in XAML in there writing out and messing with angle brackets and things just because it was easier. The designers now and the property grids make it a lot easier for you to do things like data binding, to set styles and use resources. So you have the ability to go out and simply select those. So if you want to set the style for something, to go out and just select one of the styles that's in your XAML. Or if you want to do data binding, to use, you know, a property grid, almost a wizard-like, to go out and say, hey, you know what, I want to bind to this object. Here's the property that I want to get. I don't want to have to, you know, go in and type all this stuff out. And there's also now the Windows 7 shell integration. So you have components within WPF to help you do things like the jump lists and the taskbar integration down at the bottom of the screen in your Windows 7 taskbar. Let's go out. I've just got a simple app here. And I want to go out and just show you a couple of the controls. So we'll drag a data grid on here. We'll give it some size. Now, I can come in and just say, hey, you know what? I want you to auto-generate columns. All right. If I want my item source, right, I can go and set that. So if we get our properties grid out here and I have my data grid, I can go down and find my item source. And I can now do this apply data binding. And so we could go in and just say, you know what, for this particular case, I want to use the data context. I'm just going to point out whatever's in the data context. But I can also go out and browse to another element. I could say, you know what, the data for this particular item is going to come from some other element and some other property. Or I can use relative and static resources. So I can use all these different binding models. And then I have down here the ability to set things like the path. I can apply converters. I can set all the different options on that binding. So all this stuff is just going to become part of the binding expression in the XAML, but now I don't have to type it all out and try and remember all those settings. So I'm going to go ahead and say data context. And so if we go and look, we'll see there's our item source, and it simply just says binding on it. So if I go ahead and set this as my startup and run it, I've got a collection of people out here. You can see it automatically goes out, creates that, right, lets me go in and edit these things by default and just auto-generates all that. This is kind of the quick and easy model to do that, but I can also come in that and say, you know what, I'm going to go in and define these columns myself. I want to have more control over this. So I want to have a I want to have Visual Studio crash. Let's open that back up. Look at that, right back to my screen. So I want to come in now and I'll see if I can keep this from crashing again. So I'm going to do the columns. And then under here, you can see I've got a variety of different options for the types of columns I can use. So if you've done web development, and you're doing WPF, a lot of this is very similar to what you see in ASP.NET, right, and other grids. I've got combo boxes, check boxes. I've got a text column, and then I have a template column, which allows me to decide what I want that particular column to look like and provide different templates. So I'm going to just create a text column. I'm going to say the binding equals binding, and then the path for this is going to be the first name. And we'll do another one here for the for the age. I can honestly say that this did not happen as I was working through the demos for the last 3 days. My Visual Studio has been working just fine. Maybe I should turn off the magnifier. Maybe that's the magic thing that's causing problems. It loads back up really fast, though. Of course, it keeps losing all my changes. This is one of those save and save often, right? Save. Save. All right. Now we'll get to what I actually want. We'll go to the template column. So I can do an editing template, and I can do a regular template. So I can identify what do I want this to look like when I'm just viewing it, and what does it look like when I'm actually editing it, and I can have that be two different things. So for this particular cell, I do a data template, and when I'm looking at it, I'm just going to have it be a text box. And we'll do for the text, we'll just do binding, and the path is going to be date of birth. Oops. But when I want to use the editing, I'm going to come back in and I'm going to instead use that, use a data template. I'm going to use the date picker and the selected date, then I'll do date of birth. So now I've got a different template for when I'm editing and for when I'm running. See if I can keep it from crashing this time. Oh, doesn't help if you also do auto-generate columns. So we run that, now I've got my columns, and what happens is if I come in here to edit, it doesn't work at all. Date picker, cell editing template. Ah, there it was. I just didn't go in far enough. Come on now, edit. This is one of those things as a presenter that you'd love to have happen. Everything starts getting wonky on your machine. There we go. Honestly, it's worked really well up until this morning, I promise. So there's your date picker. Just like you'd expect, you have the ability to go in, all right, pick a date. You can style it. You can apply different changes to it. It works just like you'd expect a date picker to work for the most part. There's also a calendar control, all right, that allows you to go in and just drop a calendar on and have people pick dates and do that sort of thing. Given how well that went, unless there's any questions, I'm going to move away from my WPF project that keeps crashing. All right. So one of the new things in the framework, we kind of talked about just some enhancements to the languages, to the tooling, to those sorts of things. One of the new things in the framework that personally is pretty exciting to me is the managed extensibility framework. Now, the idea here is that you've got an application, and you want to make it so that you can have drop-in functionality. I want to be able to add functionality to this particular application. I want to let you add functionality. I want to let other people add functionality. But I don't want it to just be wide open where you're going to come in and just write script. You know, it's not Visual Basic for applications. It's not that sort of thing. It's I've got an application, and it has certain things that it can expose out to you and allow you to provide implementations. And so the whole thing is based on this notion of contracts. Right? As the application developer, I'm going to be able to write contracts and say, hey, you know what? This is a particular type of contract that I want to import. I'm looking for extensions that implement this contract and can provide me this functionality. It might be that I want one extension, or I might be able to handle multiple extensions that do the same thing. So I may have an application, and I, as part of it, I'm going to do scheduling. And so I'm going to allow you to plug in. I'm going to say, hey, I import this contract. I'm looking for something that knows how to implement a scheduling contract, where I can say, you know what, I want to create an event. I want to go out and find a particular event. I don't really care what the implementation looks like. And in fact, you could drop something new in tomorrow as long as it implements that contract. So I'm going to indicate that I want to import some certain functionality. And then these extensions can also advertise that they export particular things. And you can mix and match these things together. So as the application owner, as the container owner, I could say, well, I have certain contracts that I'm looking for the extensions to fill. Those are things that I want to import. And I have certain capabilities of the host that I want to make available to any extensions. So I'm going to export out those contracts and say, look, maybe you need the ability to notify the user. You're going to do that through a particular contract where any extension then can say it needs that capability, and it will then be able to come in and call into the host and say, you know what, notify the user, here's the information. So the idea is that when I write the host and when I write the extensions, really all I know about are these contracts. They don't have any binary dependencies. They're not related to each other than through these contracts and the ability to export and import. Now, you can use contracts for entire interfaces or classes. So you can say, you know what, I have this calendaring service interface, and that's my contract, and that's what I want to import. I want to look for some extensions that have that. Or you can do it on methods. You can say, I want an extension that exports or provides a certain method to me. And here's a name, here's a signature of what I'm expecting. I might just want to call that one method from those items. You can do, like I said, you can do one or many. So you might have a model. How many people are on Twitter? Couple. So there's a lot of applications today where, all these different social networks, Facebook and Twitter, and now I'm using Yammer, which is like Twitter, but for a small group, and I have all these different things. And so there's all these applications now that try and aggregate that data for you. Right? Well, that's a perfect model of, hey, I've got my container application, and you know what? Each of the extensions then, I might want to have X number of extensions that can all provide me with feeds, right? So there might be various RSS feeds or JSON feeds, whatever it might be. So I'd have a contract that says, hey, I want to import a number of children or child extensions that know how to provide me this feed information. And then I could come along and just drop those extensions in, and automatically my host can pick those up. So let's take a quick look at a simple application like that. It's WPF also, so hopefully things will go better than the last WPF. So what I have are a couple of projects. I have my host application, which is a WPF application. I have a library that contains my contracts. And then I have one project where I've got a particular provider of data. So let's start with the contracts. You can see that the contracts themselves, there's nothing special here. This is just .NET code. They're interfaces that I've defined that said, you know what, this is what I want the contracts to look like. There's no special markup. There's no special anything with these classes or with these interfaces. So I'm just asking here, I'm going to say, look, I want to have a particular extension. I want it to be able to provide me a list of feed items. Or feed item just has a couple of properties like title, summary, and date posted. And I also have this iNotification, which I could use then to allow the allow those extensions to call back in and notify me of something happening. So my host application, I've got a reference to that assembly. I also have a reference to the system.componentModel.composition. That's essentially where the managed extensibility framework lives. It's in this composition assembly. And that's where I'm going to find all of those classes. So what I do in my application is I'm going to start with a composition container. This is the class that's going to kind of help me manage all the different parts that I'm going to compose together in my application. And I'm going to come in and create what's called a directory catalog. Now, there are different kinds of catalogs, and this is how you're going to find those extensions. The directory catalog is going to go search this particular directory for DLLs and look for the extensions out there. You've got an assembly catalog that allows you to use reflection and say, here's a particular assembly. Go find me any extensions that match in here. And so I'm going to create my container now. I'm going to initialize it with that catalog. I'm going to say compose the parts for this particular class. Go out, look at this class, and look at the contracts that it imports and exports. And then using that catalog, go find me the appropriate classes or implementations that I can use. So the key to making that happen is right here, right? When I say compose on this, it's going to go look out at this class and say, well, what are the contracts for this class? It imports those iFeed contracts. And here I've used this import many to say, look, I've got a list of these things. I want to import as many as are out there. I don't want to just find one. I want to have a collection of them. And I've done the export to say I export this particular contract as well so that those extensions will be able to work with that. Right. Now, there's a number of different overrides here for things like the contract name or contract type. If you're using as the type the same type as the contract, you don't need those. Right. It will infer that that's the contract type. If you happen to be using an implementation class for that, then you would need to explicitly call out and say, well, look, the property I have here says it's notifier, but the contract is actually iNotifier. Right? You'd need to explicitly call out and help it know that that's the particular class that or contract that you're looking for. So if we go out then to our provider, right, I have a class here just called feed container, and it has an export on it as well. Right? So it's got a reference to the composition assembly, it's got a reference to my contracts, and it simply says, look, I provide or I export a feed contract. And so what MEF does then is when we do that compose, it goes out and really just pulls these things together. It composes them, right? It finds those import and export matches. It maps everything up. And so at runtime, after I do that compose, I'm going to find that this list of iFeed contract is going to be populated with all the extensions out there that exported this particular contract. And so I don't have to go out and find them. I don't have to hook that up. It's completely dynamic. Now, what my implementation of that feed contract does is, in this case, just simply goes out to a particular directory, finds all the files in that directory, and creates feed items for that, and sends them back in. So if we run this, what we'll see is that it goes out, it brings that information back in, and then I can take that information and lay it out, not very stylishly, in my WPF application. I don't know about you, but there's all this promise of WPF and making really stellar-looking applications. I did okay with Windows Forms because it was just a nice gray, solid Windows. I have to work to get a WPF app to not look horrible. All right. So what's going on then is after I do that composition, I can simply come down and say, all right, I want to load the feed data. So as long as I've got providers, I'm just going to go through and essentially create that UI. So I create a list box. I put it in a particular column in my grid, and then I go in and set the item source to be that get feed data. So I'm just going to iterate over each of those. So if I add in other ones, I'd have a new column with new bits of data that get plopped in there. So you've got a number of different things you can do with these contracts. And I've just done a simple import-export. You can apply metadata to these things. All right, so in addition to just saying, hey, I'm exporting an iFeed container, you could add additional metadata to that to indicate that maybe it's a Twitter feed or it's a feed from of a certain type or a certain subset of data. And then as you import that, you could filter those. You could look through those particular types and look at the metadata, and you might find that, hey, you know what, I've got five different implementations of this, but based on the metadata, I only want to use three, or I only want to use one of them. So you have the ability to control a lot of that composition and decide which components you actually end up using. All right. Questions about Mel? Yes, sir. Yeah, good question. So how does the host application know which plugins to load? And that's really where the catalog comes into play. So here I'm basically telling it, go look in C:MEF. So if we go out and look in C:MEF, we'll see all that's out there is this assembly for that extension that I created. And so that directory catalog, when we say compose, is going to come out, look at this directory, look through all the assemblies out here and find which ones export the types that we need. So it says, all right, well, if you're composing on this, then this is looking to import iFeed contract. So it's going to go look in that directory, open up all the assemblies, and see if there are any classes that export that same contract. And so that's how it knows to go out and look for those assemblies in that particular location. Now, the host doesn't have any idea what that implementation of iFeed contract does, right, other than that it claims to export this particular contract and provide me this data if I ask for it. Yeah, so the question was, is it possible to add new ones without restarting the host? I'm not 100%. You can definitely I could just go drop another assembly in there and it would absolutely pick it up the next time I start. But I believe you would have to go back and you'd have to monitor that and go back and recompose. You'd have to have it, go back out and rescan that directory for those changes. I'm not 100% though. So I'll double check before we're done today, but I think you'd have to do some extra work to ask it to go rescan that and recompose everything. Okay. Oops. So the last two things I want to touch on, we're not going to go into a ton of detail for a couple of reasons. One is time, and one is I'm not sure how much interest there is. They're pretty exciting new things in the framework, but they're also not what most people would consider mainstream. One is the parallel extensions for .NET. So, you know, Microsoft and other folks are realizing, as most software developers and other people are talking about as well, that machines today have more than one core. Right? I'm pretty sure my mom went out and bought a machine, and it's a 64-bit machine with, you know, two cores on it, which she certainly doesn't need, you know, for email and Internet Explorer. But that's the common thing today, right? You go buy a new PC, you get multiple cores, and you get 64-bit. And most of our code isn't written to take advantage of that. And in order to take advantage of that, we have to start getting down and writing multi-threaded code and dealing with all that good stuff that a lot of developers don't really want to deal with. And so what the folks at Microsoft have done is said, well, we're going to try and simplify multi-threaded coding, asynchronous coding, by providing you a couple of different mechanisms for doing that to easily take advantage of the multiple cores and to give you a simpler programming model for async programming or using threads. So there's two different components here, kind of key components. One is the parallel task library. And what this does is it provides you a model of kind of abstracting away the notion of creating threads and running things where you just say, you know what, I want to create a task and I want you to go start it. And I want something underneath the covers to deal with creating the threads, figuring out what CPU, using really advanced algorithms for managing all that stuff that I don't want to think about. Right? I want the big brains that write this low-level stuff to do it for me. And so the tasks give you that, but they also give you a nicer programming model with things like cancellation tokens so that I can go out and say, you know what, I have this task that's out there running, but I need to cancel it. That can be really tricky to do if you spin up a thread and start it and you want to go try and to cancel it and join threads back. Right. It also gives you the ability to use continuation. So you can say, you know what, I have a task. I'm going to go out and I'm going to process maybe a whole bunch of files. And I'm going to do some crunching on those files. So I want that to spin up on as many threads as and as many cores as possible. And when it's done, I've got something else I want to do. And so rather than have to, you know, start that up and then do a wait and then kick off the next process, we have this notion of continuation where I can say, look, I have a task. I want you to run it, and I want you to continue with this other task. So when that's done, I want you to pick up and just go run this other code for me automatically. So the other key thing is that we have this notion of plink or plink. It's essentially parallel link to objects, right? Where what we get is in this system.threading.task.parallel class, we have methods for as parallel. And we then get things like a for each and for each of t that are optimized to do things, if they can, in parallel under the covers. So it simplifies for us where we just say, look, I want to iterate over some collection and take some action. And again, I don't want to have to think about spinning up new threads to take that action. I just want the framework to do it for me. So please go iterate over these things in parallel and do them for me. So if I go out here, I'm going to show you the last part first, the parallel link. I'm going to use a little sample that my colleague David Starr recently did a screencast on. David's one of our instructors, and he's all gung-ho about this robot programming. He wants to have this robot game that he can use in all of his samples. And so we've got this notion of robots. And so I'm going to go out and create a list of these robots. And a robot just basically has a name and a location, right? An X and a Y point. And I'm going to go out and make some number of these. In this case, I'm going to start out by making a million of these things. Right? And then I'm going to iterate over those and just call move robot. Move robot's just going to get some random direction, right? Up, down, right, left. And then it's going to call, and it's just going to move the robot. So nothing really interesting happening here, right? But I'm going through, and I'm doing some processing. I'm executing this stuff. And in iterating over these million robots as we go through. Right? So let me set that as a startup. So as we go through this million robots, you can see it takes about 5 seconds. I'm not getting too precise here with the numbers, but it takes about 5 seconds to go through those million different robots. So if I come in now and I do this parallel.forEach, I can pass in an IEnumerable. So I'm going to pass in my collection of robots, and then I can pass in an action of robot, right? How many of you are familiar with action and func from the framework? Oh, good, about half of you. Excellent. Action and func, for those of you that aren't familiar, are really just well-known delegate types, right? So an action of robot is basically a delegate that says, hey, it's a function, returns void, takes a robot, right? And there are up to, I think it's like 16 different input types now, so you can have these functions. So you don't have to go write delegates all the time. And so what I'm going to do is, instead of doing a standard for each, I'm just going to take advantage of the parallel for each. It's slightly different, right, in terms of the syntax, but I'm going to say do this in parallel now. And for each one of those, go call this function. And behind the scenes, you worry about threads, taking advantage of my two cores that I have on my laptop. Right. And so now we go through those million, okay. Only it was 4 seconds, so it's not a huge improvement. This is another one of those fun demos where it could change from time to time. Earlier it was 2. You can see I'm not getting too accurate again on the time. But the idea is that, look, if I've got stuff that could be parallelized, I want a simple way to do it. I don't want to have to think about the code I'd have to write to go in and do a for each over this and create a new thread and then make sure that all ran and join that back up, right? Just being able to do that parallel for each simplifies that greatly. Right. Now, the other thing I want to show you, just comment this out, is this notion of continuation and the idea of the tasks. So I have this task, and I have task factory. Now, you can just create a task, and you can start it, but the preferred method is actually to use this factory method. And I have this start new. And if we look, you can see it takes, again, an action as one of the options. I've also got an action of object, which is what I'm passing in. So this notion of the actions and the functions is really starting to take off within the framework itself. So for those of you that didn't raise your hand when I asked if you knew what an action is, now would be a good time to start learning more about them, because you're going to see them popping up in a lot of the APIs. A lot of the workflow APIs, a lot of the core framework APIs are going to use these. And so I'm just using a lambda here where I say, well, look, I'm going to take in some parameter called path. And from that, I'm just going to go out and I'm going to read all the lines in a file. So I'm doing path.toString because this takes an object. And so what I'm going to do is simply go out and read the machine config, because I like having demos that fail. So I'm going to go mess with my machine config and see what I can mess up. But what I want to show you is that after I create that task, I'm calling this continue with. So I'm saying, look, I don't really know how long it's going to take you to read that. I don't know how long it's going to take you to finish the task. I don't want to write code to wait for that and then do something else. I just want to tell you that, look, when you're done, here's the next thing you can do. So I'll say continue with, and I'm just going to pass in a new action here, which is L. And so then I'm going to go through, and I'm going to use that same notion. So I'm going to do the lines. I'm going to use that as parallel. and then say, for all of those things, I want you to go out and just write out the data from the from that file. So not very exciting in terms of the number crunching or that sort of thing, but one of the things you'll notice is the file is not in order, right? Because it's been parallelized. So I didn't do this in sequence. I didn't do it serially. I asked it to go out, read all the lines in, so they're originally going to be in order. But then I said, continue at, and just go out and write out those lines in parallel. So it's spinning up threads, and it's using the multiple cores, and it's just going to go out and do that stuff as fast as it can on my machine. So there's some options here when you go out and you think about doing link queries. Right? If you go out and you parallelize this stuff over different CPUs and threads, you've got to have different ways to merge things back. So they've got options for you to indicate how you want to merge those things back together so that you can optimize for those sorts of conditions as well. Questions on that before I move to the last? No? All right. So the last thing I want to touch on is the dynamic language runtime. Again, this is where a lot of the enhancements to the C# language came in. And the idea is that we've got at Microsoft people now working on Iron Python, Iron Ruby. Those are the two big ones. I think there's a couple other dynamic languages they're working on that are essentially implementations of those languages that will run on the .NET framework. So if you want to program in Python or you want to program in Ruby, but you like having the base class library, you want to be able to write your Python but call out and use all those APIs in .NET. Or you're creating an application and you want to allow people to write some code to go in your application, you could write your application and say, hey, you know what, if you want to script this thing or if you want to write some script, you can go write some Python and I'll run that and host it in my C# application. So this whole notion of the dynamic language runtime is how do I bridge the gap between .NET languages that are statically typed and the dynamic languages, which aren't. And that's where we get that dynamic keyword. And we also have a new thing called the expando object, which I think people just wanted to have a fun name. But the expando object works much like types do in dynamic languages, where you can essentially create an instance of this thing and start adding properties to it simply by setting them. Right. So if we go out here, I'm going to go out and just add a new project here. We'll go out and call some Python code. So we'll call that Python hosted in C#. So what I'm going to do, I've gone out to CodePlex and I've downloaded the latest release of the Iron Python stuff. So I've got that installed. So I can come out and add a reference. Go out to my program files. So I've got Iron Python 2.6. Oops. If we go and look, then I've got all of these pieces. So I've got the scripting, Microsoft Dynamic, and then the two Iron Python modules. So I'm going to do using ironpython.hosting. I'm going to say create runtime. And so now I've got a Python runtime created in my C# app that I can use. So now I can go out and say, all right, well, I have a dynamic, and I want to use a file. So if we go out, where did I? I think I put it under C demos. So I've got a little Python out here. You thought my VB was bad. You should see me write Python. So let's do this. Let's start out with something simple. I'm just going to do a little hello world. So I've got, I'm importing sys. I'm just defining a function called hello world. All right, we're going to print out something to the console. Nothing too exciting. New language sort of thing. So I'm going to say use file, and it was C demos, and it's called python-def.py. And I've got that dynamic over here. Right? So again, I get no IntelliSense here. I just have to know that I've got a method over there called hello world. And so this is where that dynamic dispatching of the methods comes in, right? I don't really know at compile time. This is a dynamically typed language in Python. I don't really know what that object looks like. And so the dynamic object has to just be able to let me declare that method call and be okay with it. Oop, wrong startup project. So if we run that, you can see then we get the hello world coming out. It's gone out. Basically, I've taken a method definition in Python, pulled that into my C sharp, and just executed it from the C sharp code. Right. Now, I want to go a little farther because I want to use the expando object. So I'm going to use system dynamic. So I'm going to have this expando object called person. Actually, let me, did I mention this is going to release in a couple weeks? And then we won't be using this this RC. All right. So I've got dynamic. Person equal new expando object. I'm going to re-add my using statement. And so now, because it's dynamic, I can, and it's an expando object, I can say, hey, you know what? Person dot name equals Matt. And what the expando object allows me to do is I just declared that as a property. You can put any methods you want on there. You'll put properties on there, and it automatically, now that object has that property, and I could do things like come in and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to pass that into that Python. And I'm going to use person.name. Right? Because, again, the dynamically typed language is the same thing. They don't really care. It's not statically typed. I'm just telling it I'm passing something in. It's going to, at runtime, try and call that name property. And, of course, since it crashed, it reset my startup project. Oops. What did I do? Ah, thank you. Notepad doesn't give me the IntelliSense either. Okay. Right. So there we get the hello Matt Milner now. So I can take that expando object, put whatever properties and types I need or want on it for the dynamic language like Python, and I can pass that into those functions now and take full advantage of those dynamic languages that are out there as well. So those are kind of the key things in C sharp, the dynamic objects and the expando objects for working with a dynamic language runtime. The thing to keep in mind is that while you've got those in the framework, the full DLR, right? When I added in the Iron Python, I had to pull in that Microsoft.scripting and those sorts of things. There are other components that make up the dynamic language runtime, right? You have the CLR. And it now has support for the dynamic and the expando object. The dynamic language runtime sits on top of that and enables these other languages to execute. And so you need to go out and download that stuff as well. If you go download just a particular language like Iron Python, you'll get all those pieces that you need. And this is enabled now not just for client apps, but also for rich client apps. So there's examples out there of using this with Silverlight as well and some other client application frameworks so that you can take advantage of the same stuff, not just from full .NET applications. All right. And with that, we'll kind of wrap up the first module of the day for the what's new in .NET 4, and I'll see if there's any questions. Yes. Say that one more time. Good question. How does the debugger work with the dynamic objects? So if we go in and lose all of our screen real estate here. If you take a look at the object, right? Now we're at runtime. It knows that it did this use files, but it has this script scope, right? We've got variables that come out here. There's my function. So it depends on your perspective. Does it work? Yes. Does it look exactly like you'd want it to? Maybe not from a C-sharp perspective, right? It is going to give you information about the dynamic components that are in there. Right? If you get into the person, right, you can see it's an expando object, and that, right, essentially keeps track of all these properties down inside of a dictionary. And so You can get down into those things, but it basically keeps a dictionary of the named properties and their values. And then at runtime, it's able to, when you use the property syntax, it basically goes down in the dictionary and pulls those out and gets them. So you can get in there for the expando object and see some of that at runtime. I was going to look at another... Let's go in here and look at this one so you can see this one's not using the expando object or the... So if you look now at that dynamic, right, now I'm not using the expando object or the dynamic language stuff. I'm just using dynamic with a particular class. And so at runtime, it knows that it's a person. All right, it's got all the properties then for the person. You can see that. So it kind of depends on what the dynamic's pointing to. Right, in terms of what the debugger is going to show you and what you're going to see as you're running those apps. Other questions? Yeah, so what's a practical case for using the expando object? Primarily for working with those dynamic languages. Right, that's the main use case is I want to be able to, in C-sharp, create an object that I can pass to Python or Ruby or one of these dynamic languages that will actually work over there. All right? If I create a .NET class, it's not necessarily going to translate over into the Iron Ruby or the Iron Python space. So that's the main purpose of the expando object, is to be able to create an object in the statically typed world of C-sharp that will work and function well in the dynamic world of Python or Ruby and some of these other languages. Oh, good question. Can you debug through the extensions in MEF? So if I go in here and set a debug in there and it loads it up, I should be able to because it's going to load that into the process space. That's in the host. It's in there. So, yeah, so now we're in the file provider. I feed contract. I didn't do it. So there we go. So, yeah, so that's inside of the extension. So if you put a breakpoint in that extension, right, it's going to get loaded up into the app domain. Right? If there's breakpoints in there, it's going to see those and it's going to hit those and load them up. Yep, way in the back. Oh, good question. Could dynamic objects be used for binding in Silverlight? I'm not 100% sure, so I'm going to defer for a minute. I'll double check. I'm confused in my head about dynamic objects versus some of the anonymous types. So let me double check on that. I'm not sure that they can. All right. Yes, sir. Oh, can you create a new version of a contract in MEF? Yeah, so are you looking at I want to have the existing ones work and have version 2 and have new ones come in and take version 2? Yeah, and generally you would do that my take would be you would do that much the way you do versioning with interfaces in general. So you might have a new contract that extends the old one and adds in functionality. And when you do inheritance that way, it picks up the contract pieces as well. So then you could have iFeed notification 2 or Microsoft's favorite way of naming their interfaces where they just slap a 2 or something on the end of it. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and break. If anybody has any more questions, feel free to come down. We'll start back up at 10:45 and look at ASP.NET. Thanks.